The Community Action League is a collaborative effort of local organizations and nonprofits. Our goal is to raise awareness of issues that impact people in the Gallatin County and discuss the organizations that listeners can engage with that are relevant to these topics. On our show, we will discuss the intersectionality or connections between topics at the local, national, and global levels. We encourage cooperation and community organization, information sharing, and creating a connected service network to best serve and educate individuals in our community and beyond. To learn more about topics like consent, housing, transportation, human rights, addiction, and more, you can tune in every Thursday at 7 p.m. You can contact us at communityactionleague@gmail.com to request a topic or share your thoughts. In today's show, we're going to be talking about vulnerability and issues that impact our community. So my name is Emma, and I am with the Heart Initiative, which is a student organization at Montana State that works to raise awareness and combat human trafficking in Montana and beyond. We have some really great individuals and organizations here today, and so I'll let them introduce themselves.
Hello, I'm Patrick Jeffers. I'm the president of SAGES, which stands for the Society of American Indian Graduate Students. We've been around since 2010, and our mission is to support graduate research and professional development while encouraging community involvement and promoting tribal cultural awareness. I myself am a graduate student here at MSU in the Native American Studies Department and represent the Sault Ste. Marie Band of Chippewa.
My name is Erica Ross. I'm also a member of the Society of American Indian Graduate Students. And I'm a graduate student for the Native American Studies Master's Program here at MSU.
Hi, my name's Kaylee. I'm in AmeriCorps Vista serving with the Montana Racial Equity Project. The Montana Racial Equity Project is a nonprofit and nonpartisan organization. We advocate equity and justice for all historically marginalized, disenfranchised, and oppressed peoples in Montana, which is basically anyone who's melanated, but we also advocate for LGBTQ+, the two most historically persecuted religious groups, Jewish and Muslim, as well as some mental and physical disabilities. And we educate, train, and activate organizers, individuals, groups, organizations, institutions, and businesses to invest in interrupting racism, bigotry, and prejudice whenever encountered.
Hi, my name is Jamel Phillips. I'm a senior at MSU, studying community health with a minor in political science. I'm the vice president of the Black Student Union. The Black Student Union's mission is to advocate for the Black community, to embrace and educate about Black culture and issues for Black from Black students' perspectives, and to provide a safe space for Black students on campus.
So all of us here deal with issues relating to vulnerable populations and people who are treated differently because of their race or ethnicity or economic status. And so I think it would be really awesome to dive in. Pat, would you like to start us off as to like why you're interested in the work that you do with SAGES and why you're getting your master's degree in the program that you are?
Of course. That's a very big question. I definitely work with SAGES. I really like working with SAGES because in a lot of places, in a lot of states in this country, there is a Native American population, but it's kind of considered an invisible minority. And in every major city, in every state, there's at least some amount, there's some percentage of a population that's a Native American, Indigenous, American Indian, however you call it. But their issues usually go unheard in a lot of cases, mainly due to this same problem of having a small population base. So with SAGES, one of our main goals is to promote awareness of these issues and have these voices be heard. Whereas in a lot of cases, especially with different forms of media, more modern mass media, these voices aren't necessarily heard very loudly, if at all.
Yeah. And often I think Native Americans are seen as a population that existed at one point, but that they're extinct or that they aren't really relevant anymore. Can you either Erica or Pat talk more to that?
Sure. There's a vanishing myth theory, the idea that Native peoples no longer exist here, that they died off a long time ago. But in reality, we have 2.5 million Native American people in the United States, and they're the fastest growing minority people that we have here. And they exist in every state, in every major city, like Pat was talking about. There's not a place in North America that doesn't have a history of Native American identity tied to it. But more than a history, they're definitely a present people now. And there's a lot of really wonderful things happening in Indian country. Part of SAGE's goal is to focus on those really great things, bring them to light, and help different students from various backgrounds and various disciplines to learn how to empower themselves as Native American students, but also teaching non-Native Americans how to be allies, how to be aspiring allies to a community that we should be representing.
Yeah, definitely. And I know that theme of invisibility and feeling like people aren't relevant or that they don't face challenges or oppression is also pretty common for other ethnicities and other historically marginalized groups. Would you like to talk a little bit more to that, Kaylee?
Yeah, absolutely. Like you were saying, there's this idea that, oh, just because I'm not facing this type of discrimination, prejudice, or racism, then it's not happening to you. And what our organization does, and I think a ton of other organizations do as well, we're just trying to bring awareness that this is our reality. And more people we'd like to call people in rather than calling them out, because calling them out isn't a conversation. It's gonna set the person on a defensive mode rather than if we call them in, then it's a conversation about, like, let's talk about microaggressions. Let's talk about racial lenses and cultural lenses and how that affects our perceptions of different groups, because some people may never interact with another person of a person of color until they get to college or until they're in a job, and then there's the one black colleague or the one Native colleague, and they don't know what's right and they don't know what's wrong. I mean, there has to be education about that.
Yeah, so like breaking those stereotypes and fears down, kind of.
Yeah, for sure. Because if we keep living in a world where we're stereotyping certain groups and ethnicities, then we're never going to have progress. People need to understand they're not representing their entire race. They are themselves and they are an individual. And that is not a luxury that a lot of minorities and different ethnicities get to have.
Yeah. Yeah, so it kind of sounds like tokenism. Would you guys, anybody like to talk a little bit more about why that is so problematic?
I can start. With tokenism, there's an idea that, oh, we do need another voice. We need a Native American or Indigenous person, or we need a black person to come in and give us a different point of view. But then it's, they're that one person. And it's more like a show and tell, like, hey, we're diverse. We have one person of color, versus actually looking at the issues and being like, we need to be more aware, we need to bring in other voices, not just one, because then it's still a way making them feel like an other rather than being part of a conversation.
Mm-hmm. So it's almost like instead of a different group talking for the entire group, it's one person out of the entire group expected to represent everybody. Is that kind of the picture?
Yeah, and there's an added danger when you're thinking about tokenizing an Indigenous person as well, and that's the issue with Pan-Indianism. And to give a definition of Pan-Indianism, it's the concept that one Native person, or that all of the Native tribes of the United States and South America are all the same. When all tribes are different, even if they're in the same culture area, if they're in the Great Plains or the Southwest or the Northeast, their tribes are all very specific, just culturally, linguistically. So when you do pick out that one token Native, you don't know what tribe they're representing, and their voice doesn't necessarily represent, if they're a Diné or a Navajo person, their voice doesn't necessarily represent the Haudenosaunee or the Iroquois people up in the Northeast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. Like with Native Americans, either we think that they existed at one point and not anymore, or we think of them as one like homogenous group, and that both of those are just false.
We need to see that a lot in like the Black community. Like people like to think that like Black people are just like in Africa or in America, but no, we're like everywhere. And also we're individuals first. We came into this world by ourselves, but I see a lot in the media of like one like popular Black person says something, they like speaking for the whole Black community, and that's not the case. We all have different ideals, different political views, and that one person is not like our mouthpiece for the whole community, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And I noticed that in your mission statement, you were talking a bit about creating a space for students and other individuals to talk about these issues and have like that safe space. Can you talk a little bit more about why that space is so important and how difficult it is or might be for students who are from a minority group, how that can be difficult?
It's important because I think the Black community or Black/African-American population at MSU when I first started here was like less than 1%. Now we're at a little bit over the 1%, but that's like 250 Black students. I think I'm one of the only two Black girls in my dorm on campus.
Wow.
And I'm the only Black girl on my floor. So most of my friends here are predominantly white. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that you should just be friends with someone based off their race, but there's certain situations and certain problems only another person of like your group or like your race or of your organization would like understand, like microaggressions. For instance, there was this girl on my freshman floor. She was really friendly, a really nice girl, but every time like she said hi to me, she would say, "What's up, homie?" or "What's up, girlfriend?" And I was like, Is she like addressing me like that because I'm Black? And then I was expressing myself to one of my friends. She's like, "Oh, don't overthink it. She's just being friendly." And I don't know if like she honestly thinks like that or she's just never been in that situation to understand that. When I talked to some of my Black friends, they're like, that sounds very questionable because maybe she is talking to you like that because she thinks that's how you talk to a Black person. Like certain things that like another Black person or another Indigenous person or another Latinx person can pick up on that someone that's not from your race or ethnicity or marginalized group wouldn't understand. And if you're like surrounded by predominantly people that are not of like your race or ethnicity or marginalized group, you have to keep that all inside because you can't express yourself because you're not going to validate your concerns or emotions. So it's important to have a safe space, whether it be BSU or the Native American Indian Club or any of the other racial, ethnic, or like marginalized groups, to talk about things that you couldn't normally talk about with people that don't go through what you go through on the daily.
Yeah, it sounds like those shared experiences are really important.
Yeah, here on campus we have the American Indian Council, which is a room in the basement of Wilson Hall where it's available for American Indian students and really anybody, but mostly American Indian students to gather and just be in the company of a shared experience. It was just announced this week, since we've been celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day, that we will be having an American Indian Hall on campus. I think it's like a $20 million project that was promised to the Native American community here on campus several years ago, 2002. And it's just now come to light. They're expecting to break ground in spring of 2019 and open classes in 2021. And for a campus that, for Montana specifically, because there is a very large Native American population here, but even for MSU specifically, because we have a sizable Native American population here, having a place to gather that isn't a basement, that is proud, that is a firm standing building that everyone can share in community, knowledge, ideology, ceremony, a place where the rest of the campus community who may not be Native can also come to ask questions. and come to like reach out in allyship and come to figure out how to incorporate Indigenous education into their classroom. Having that space is so important, and reaffirming that you deserve to be here.
Yeah, that's really powerful.
The American Indian Hall is actually going to be built near Hannon Hall on campus. There's currently a metal teepee-resembled structure there to symbolize where the building has planned to be for quite a long time. It's from what I understand, some pretty prime real estate on the MSU campus. So the fact that that's stayed in control for the American Indian community is excellent.
And you said it's been in the works for quite a few years now?
Yeah, 2002 they started talking about the need for a facility more than just a basement area. Also a facility for like the academic purposes that we do here on campuses, not just for hanging out and community gathering, but also where we can all brainstorm. It's been in the works for a very long time. It's seen three different university presidents come through and commit to that, and it's taken a long time to get the money to get here, but it's finally here and everyone is so excited about that announcement.
Yeah, and there are quite a few like Native American studies classes and programs, as you guys are both in that. Would you guys like to share a little bit more about that department?
Sure. We have here on campus, the university requires a diversity credit. So we offer Introduction to Native American Studies. It's a 105 class. It's a big class, but a lot of people take it to fulfill that diversity credit. But beyond that, we also have classes focusing on specific Montana Native communities, the tribes here in Montana. We have a Native American food systems class. We also have federal Indian law and policy, if you're looking into the legal part of federal Indian identity. We also have some classes that kind of like come and go. We've had ecological development.
We've also had a couple Indigenous planning courses and even have some courses that are mixed between both our department as well as the education department that specialize in teaching Native Americans as well as other minority groups in a higher education context.
That's really great. Is that pretty common for a state school to have that many resources and...
As far as my knowledge is concerned, it is not. This is a very relatively unique case, both where I studied, got my undergraduate with the University of Tulsa in Oklahoma. They did not have the same number of Native American courses, particularly not engaging with the contemporary and modern aspects of Indigenous culture and, you know, the way of, their way of being. It's you can see historical aspects and anthropological aspects throughout many universities across the country, but one thing that Montana State specializes in my opinion, is having this modernity aspect.
Yeah, the thriving to get the conversation out of the history classroom and into present day conversation about real people that exist now, that are living lives now and facing challenges and overcoming substantial things now. MSU does a really great job of that. There's a couple other institutions. University of Oklahoma, down in Oklahoma, does have a large Native Studies program where they cover, I think, even more than we do. There's also universities in Arizona and New Mexico. I believe there's one in Colorado, but that might be about it.
Wisconsin and Minnesota have a few programs as well. Mainly the states that have significant Native populations or reservation populations are the places that you're going to find more of these contemporary programs.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of the Western states. Yeah, and I think that you mentioned, Erica, that you're from Oklahoma. Yeah, how did you get interested in this type of work and like study?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I have been around and near and close to Indigenous people all my life, from friends that I grew up with to their families, the kids that lived across the street. Their grandmother is a award-winning Native artist. But as I became an adult, I started working for Indian casinos, and I began dealing blackjack. And Native American casinos always occur on Indian land, which means that Indian law is the primary law source there. And I have been constantly wowed at how many non-Native people don't take Indian law as a legitimate and real thing, even though it has significant hierarchy to state law. So that's really where I got interested in studying Indigenous studies further, watching gamblers just totally dismiss what they thought was irrelevant, but then having to have a serious conversation with tribal police and then going through the tribal court system for any wrongdoings. That was what piqued my interest, and then I've just continued looking at all of the different sort of educational and quagmires that we have, where even in American education and public school education, we're really not talking about Native American people beyond a history context, especially in communities with large populations. That's a remarkable disservice for everyone. Even for non-Native people, we really should be recognizing and paying respect to entire ways of life that surround us, beautiful ways of life that surround us, and give us a different perspective, even on our own existence.
I think our biggest issue is that, like, we want to be sustainable. Like, we want to be around for, like, years and years, you know. We want to leave, like, a legacy for other Black students who come after us, because the BSU was around in the 90s at MSU, but then people graduated, the population of Black students went down, and then it was just non-existent. And for the longest time, a lot of our members, you know, they felt sort of alone. It could be because a lot of us aren't from the Montana area. I don't want to, like, generalize or play into the stereotype, but a few of us are athletes that just came up here to play football, basketball, etc. A couple of us came for engineering programs. Most of us are STEM, and we're far away from home, you know, but being able to, like, have a community of people behind you that have your back is very important, and we want to make sure that we can have that for years and years to come. Like, last February, we took a trip to University of Montana, and they have, like, the oldest BSU in Montana, and they have a thriving African American Studies program, and we don't offer that here. But, like, that's one of our goals. We want to have an African-American studies program. We want to have a room or a building, because right now our meetings are in the graphic design room on Wednesdays. But we want to have, like, a building, you know, something to leave for future students. That's what's really important to us right now.
Yeah, what do you see as the biggest challenges to continuing BSU and making it sustainable, as well as having programs like African studies?
I think one of our biggest issues is, like, when it first got started, like, a lot of people thought we're trying to be divisive. Almost like, you guys aren't already allowed here. Why are you trying to make it harder for yourself and, like, isolate yourself from, like, the general population? And I don't think a lot of people realize that, like, no matter what, we're always going to be seen as Black first. We're always going to be that one Black student in the back of the class. Was going to be the token Black friend in the friend group here. So where are you, the other? Like, I don't know. Have you guys ever seen, like, the Black hair care section at, like, Walmart or Target? It's like a little three rows in the back, and it says ethnic hair care. Like, we're already the other. So just, like, congregating and being together isn't, like, making the situation worse. And I feel like a lot of people don't realize that. Like, they think that we're trying to be difficult or, like, trying to separate ourselves from other people, but it's mainly just about, like, having a community of people to support you.
Yeah.
To be your family out here.
Definitely, to have that sense of community. One way that I've heard it described really well is that white is the norm, and so it's invisible, and so anything that is outside of that norm or that structure is seen as the other, yeah, marginalized because of that.
I think one way to think of that is, like, think of Band-Aids. When you go to buy a Band-Aid, it doesn't match.
Yeah, the skin color.
The skin color does not match any, most people who are non-white. It's like, glaring, like, how big the difference is. And that the norm is for whiter or tannish skin.
And how many white people think about that, right? And it's a thing that non-white people experience.
Little things that, like, I feel like people take for granted, like, little privileges that you have, like, not having like stereotypes, like, I don't know, like, I feel like the worst one I've heard, and I hear like people say it all the time, is like, Black people don't have fathers, like our fathers just abandoned us, and like we were raised by like our single mother.
That's awful.
When in reality, like where I grew up, most people grew up in two-parent households. I'm like, what is even that stereotype? You know, it's like little things like that.
And the history of that stereotype was, most of it was systemic, from the war on drugs, where crack cocaine was made number one drug offense. So,
or the transatlantic slave trade that was separating families from each other. Like, people don't like take that into account. And then if like you say something, they'll say like you're being too sensitive, or they'll call you an SJW or something like that.
Oh, like a social justice warrior?
Yeah, like, oh, it's just a joke. You're so soft. Or like a snowflake or something like that. When, like, people don't, like, take into account, like, those little things, they do, like, hurt someone's self-esteem.
Yeah.
And also have you, like, questioning who you are as an individual in a marginalized group.
Yeah, and it's not just, like, one little thing once, and that's the only thing ever. It's little thing after little thing after little thing.
Like, it like builds up that trauma of like being discriminated against or followed around in a store, or like when people call you a racial slur or something like that. And like, I don't know, I'm speaking for myself, but like when things like that happen, I'm too embarrassed to tell anybody about it. So I usually just internalize it and keep it to myself.
And then even if you do confront the person, it's not like that always goes well, and they could just minimize it and make it seem like you're making a big deal out of nothing, which hurts even more.
Yeah. And I'm glad you bring this up, and I'm going to throw it back a little bit to when we were talking about microaggressions before. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's really important to have a safe space, to have a building, to have a room, a place where you can go with people that understand. Because at least in my experience, I grew up in Chicago. I didn't grow up on a reservation. I didn't grow up by my tribal people. I didn't grow up with my tribal heritage. But what I did grow up around were a bunch of non-native suburban Chicagoans. And it was an interesting experience not being able to escape microaggressions. You know, I'd be with people who I would consider my best friends, people who I still see. And it would be a really hot day, and they'd be like, oh yeah, Pat, how about you do a rain dance for us? Or like, hey, Pocahontas, come over here. Like, hey, Squanto, what's up? Like that kind of stuff. And a lot of things, especially with microaggressions, they don't even realize that they're harmful. They think they're being funny. They think they're being clever. A lot of the time, they don't understand because they've never had microaggressions, you know, thrown their way. It's hard to kind of view it in that context. So that's why, I mean, I like what you were saying about having a safe space, because that is a good space to express these issues with people that understand.
And like also like the media, like the other day, me and like some of like the Black Student Union board were talking about representation in the media. And also like if you see a successful Black person, they're either like an athlete or they're an entertainer, or like they're like Oprah, a very successful talk show host. Then I was like, guys, what about like for Asian or like Native people? Like, you barely ever see a Native person in a movie. Like, I can only like think of like one time. It was like, have you guys seen Twilight? That whole werewolf thing. I was like, wow. I'm sitting here like complaining because like I can only think of like athletes and entertainers, and like for Native people or for like Asian people, it's non-existent. It's not even there. Representation, and that matters. Like seeing someone, like seeing yourself and other people, and like, wow, if they can do it, I can do it. But for like a lot of people of color, they don't have that.
Yeah, those role models are just so important.
And especially for Asian Americans too, that's such a blanket term. There are so many different ethnicities that are wrapped into Asian American. Like when we think of Asian American, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, but from Philippines, Malaysia, Thailand, so many different countries, but they're wrapped up into this model minority myth, and they face as much discrimination as everyone else does. Like, every non-white group faces a form of discrimination, but they get wrapped into this idea that, oh, like, there's a Chinese person in this movie, so representation for Asians. When it's like, there are far more different ethnicities relative to Asian Americans. That's not even a conversation right now, because we're still stuck. I'm just trying to get more Asian actors into movies, films, and our daily lives and through media.
Yeah, that reminds me of when I was in middle school, there was, like, I was in a mostly white area, and there was one Asian girl, and, like, she got a B on a test once, and so everybody started calling her Bijan instead of Asian. And so, like, and people were like, oh, it's so funny and clever, and she's like, that's not, like, what? Guys, come on, like, and it just, it doesn't hit people that that is so, like, harmful.
Even talking about representation in media, for a lot of Native people, the representation that exists in the media is historicized. It's Dances with Wolves, it's Indian in the Cupboard, it's Pocahontas. It's these elements that only promote historical views of particularly Great Plains tribes. I can tell you, in the class that I teach the introduction to one to Native American studies, how many people in the first day of class think that every Native person, their ancestors, or maybe even them, live in a teepee. I mean, my tribe, we use wigwams. I don't know anything about teepees. I couldn't put a teepee together. That's not me. It's interesting when you think about this historicization of Native people, even in all the media. That's why it's important to get this modernity aspect out, so that people can stop thinking that Native people live in teepees. So that the first thing that I'm asked by a kid when I meet them and tell them I'm Indigenous is, "Oh, do you ride a horse to school?" Like, "Oh, do you live in a teepee?" Like that kind of stuff is what needs to be kind of taken out of the situation, and more education on the topic needs to be presented.
Yeah, you know, sitting here and listening to all this, I'm not Native. I come from a white family, a white community. I was raised white. And what really frustrates me is that, like, all of these stereotypes that exist for a marginalized community, it really revolves around the white conversation. And there is no reason in 2018 why these still exist. White conversation has to do better. We have to be better allies at confronting other white community members when these are perpetrated. There's just no excuse for it. And, you know, I think that is where we see a lot of dismantling. Unfortunately, there have been many times where I have been at presentations with fellow people in my cohort who are Native and who say something, and it's not believed until a white person says it. And that's ridiculous. It's absolutely crazy. The white normativity of this country is toxic. And unfortunately, I really think that it has to be dismantled from the inside. We need to be asking our white brothers and sisters to do better. There's no other way around it.
There's 2 points to that. During our Dismantling Hatred workshop, it's we have two teachers. One is our executive director, who is a black woman, and the other is a white woman who's a volunteer. She's fantastic. And our executive director can say one thing, and the students will be like, okay, like, I don't really get it. And then her white co-teacher will say the exact same thing, maybe, like, switch a few words. Then they're like, oh my goodness, I get it. And it really, having a white voice saying it really changes how someone's understanding, which is, it's really sad. Well, unfortunately, but it's something that a lot of marginalized groups know, that if it comes from a white person, more white people will believe it. And, like, being an ally, it's a long journey. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to have to keep learning and pushing forward. But you also have to be tapped into it. You can't just be like, oh, I'm an ally. But then it's like you like something on Facebook, but then the next day you microaggress someone, like you touch a black girl's hair because it's in an afro, and you're like, oh my goodness. And like, you can't say you're an ally. The marginalized group has to be like, you're an ally, you're doing the work, you are showing up to these conversations, you are learning, you are going to events that will help push our mission forward. You can't just self-identify as an ally. You have to do the work and people have to be like, yeah, you are an ally.
Yeah, a good friend of mine that I've met here in this program, the way that she identifies with allyship is she always says aspiring ally. You don't ever get to decide that you've been made an ally. You are always working towards it as a non-member of that community. And you have to be held accountable. People need to be able to look at you and hold you accountable and ask who you're accountable to. If you don't have anyone of that community that that you speak to regularly that helps keep you in check, then no, you're not actually an ally. Like you said, you don't get to self-identify. It's all about aspiring. It's a constant work in progress. As non-people of color in any marginalized group, white folks have to be constantly remaking themselves. They have to be constantly be pushing back in their own community. And the most important thing is they have to make space for those people of that community to represent themselves. And I think that teaching the 105 class, we have this happen quite a lot in the Native American Studies class. It's not just enough to show up and hold other white students accountable for the misconceptions and the myths about Native identity. But you have to be willing also to step aside and let that void be filled by an actual Native voice. Speaking realities, speaking their experience, and validating who they are. Like, as white communities, we don't hold the key to validation. People's experiences are what they are. I really hate that saying, walk a mile in each other's shoes. Let's stop walking these pointless miles and just believe people about what they experience as a living person. That's really real. And I think that's really the first step at breaking down your own barrier of being a non-person of color of any marginalized community you're trying to be an ally to.
And I also feel like people don't just like take your word when you like say, oh, that's racist or that's a microaggression. They want you, as like Judith, the executive director of Amtrak, has told me, they want you to relive your trauma. Like, they want examples, they want to hear stories from like 10 years ago. And like, I don't think people realize how like detrimental that is to you as an individual to have to like relive something from your childhood that caused so much pain and heartbreak, not just to you, but probably to your parents, because my parents immigrated here from like Liberia. A small country in West Africa. They never really experienced racism until they came to America. You know, it wasn't really a concept for them. While we lived here, I went to a predominantly white school. I was the only black girl in my whole class, and it was like 100 kids. And like me running to my mom crying about like someone making a comment about my hair and not being invited to like a birthday party because someone's parents they don't like black people, like, for me to like have to like relive that story for someone to like, for me to get my point across to someone is ridiculous. You should just be able to take my word for it.
Absolutely. That reminds me of a saying, the oppressed should not have to explain their oppression to their oppressors. Does anybody have any more thoughts going on for that?
Absolutely. Just, you know, believing people and their experience and being willing to acknowledge that you play a role in that. White community, man, we're pretty much responsible for the majority of oppressive experiences. And at some point we have to acknowledge, even if it wasn't my actual ancestors that did it, I'm still a part of the system that continues it. And until I've like looked at dismantling that and held myself accountable for dismantling that, I mean, it's still very real. In the 105 class, we have them write weekly papers. And at the beginning of the semester, there's always a lot of stereotypes about Native alcoholism or total misunderstanding about ceremony in general, or not accepting the boundary to like what you're allowed to see as an outsider, especially when it comes to something so intimate as faith and ceremony. We struggle with getting students to realize their boundaries, to challenge their own myths, and then to be willing to actually go in search of accounts from Native people about their experience and immediately validate it. We do see some change. I mean, sometimes, but most of the time, we see some change like throughout the semester. The first paper is always like really like, oh goodness. The last paper, we have some growth. But it's all about pushing yourself to be a better person on this planet, really, and I think that you owe it to everybody here to be a better person.
Yeah, I have a colleague who said some wise words a while back in reference to checking one's privilege and checking one's self in these contexts. And this isn't just for non-native, non-minority folks. This is for everyone. And I think it's very profound. And it's saying, everyone needs to check their own privilege. And when you're actually doing the work, it's not something that ends. You're kind of always working on it. You're always trying to dismantle the oppressive system that you've been raised in, whether you've been like one of the victims or one of the oppressors you've been raised in, and you're always trying to break it down. And, if you feel like you're stressing out and you're starting to develop a mental illness, then that means you're doing it right. And that's a big part of it, because it's a stressful experience. And, it's going to be, it's tough and it takes a long time, but it's worth doing. And in order to relate with people and understand their experiences, that you would never understand in the first place, honestly, it's important to understand where your location is in all of it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it sounds like empathizing and really listening is really important to help people just go through like what they're feeling and recognize like the historical trauma and the historical factors that lend all of the things that are happening today.
Yeah, I would actually say that it's not empathy in the same way that dominant culture understands empathy, mm-hmm. because empathy refers to that you can put yourself in those shoes. And there are incredible limits that white community has that we cannot put ourselves in the shoes of someone who is oppressed because of the color of their skin or because of their identity, their ancestral history, the historic trauma they carry. And in that way, you really need to be able to believe someone's experience and to try your absolute best to understand the emotional pain. And once you realize that you can't actually understand what that's like, that's where you're really pinpointing the differences that are made systemically. And you need to be trying to break that down using weaponizing your privilege. Use your privilege as a weapon to speak louder in communities that don't want to listen to people of color. To make way for people of color to be in that room and to fill that voice, to try and assert that you don't know how that feels. You don't know what it's like. If you've never experienced that, you can't possibly know that pain. And that in itself should be indicative of a problem, that you can't possibly know what that pain is like.
Absolutely. So, Kaylee, what do you see as some of the contemporary issues that Montana Rep deals with?
So this is going to be like a blanket answer, because in every sect, every system within this country, there is a issue regarding race, bigotry, and prejudice, whether it's economic discrimination, housing discrimination, which is wrapped within economic, job discrimination, still economic, voting discrimination with new voter ID laws, and voter purging, Black Lives Matter with police brutality, and just ensuring that people are being respected rather than just being, oh, they're a criminal, or they're going to hurt me because they're Black, or they look. Yeah, the idea of it was popular in Jim Crow to stereotype a Black person as being like this extra or supernatural strong being that could do a lot of harm to the white community.
We definitely see that in our criminal justice system, right? Mm-hmm. With disproportionate numbers of African Americans in prison.
Yeah, criminal justice system. So there's so many systems that have so many issues, and it really needs to be dismantled. And the way to dismantle it is through it's up to white people, because they're the ones who created it. And they're the ones who's going to have to dismantle it. So our biggest contemporary issue is raising awareness and gaining more allies, not just allies, anti-racist people who want to bring down the system and ensure racial and social equity, not equality, because equality just means everyone has the same. And there's been over 200 years of discrimination on a lot of marginalized groups in America, especially Black and Indigenous, Latinx, Asian American, like so many groups. And you can't just be like, okay, we're all equal when you're on the starting line so much farther back. So it really has to be equity. We have to realize that more new programs and systems have to be put into place to really try to make bring down those walls that have been put up for hundreds prior. So we really need more people to weaponize their whiteness for good, to use their whiteness in a sense of bringing down the hatred. And we see an uptick of hatred and intolerance in America right now.
And hate crimes too, right?
Mm-hmm. Does it spike?
Yeah, and for the past couple of years. And we need to shut that down.
Yeah, so what are some of the events or ways in which you raise awareness and get those allies and people who are anti-racism?
So we will hold community forums whenever there's like a huge event coming up. Like we had one for Women's Day back in, or the day when we got the right to vote back in September or August, I forget. But recognizing that when women got the right to vote, it was really for white women, and it was a very discriminatory movement that intentionally excluded Black women, and they saw it as a way to enhance white supremacy versus actually getting all women the right to vote. So we did a community forum on that. But we have two key workshops. One is Dismantling Hatred Workshop, Skills and Strategies You Can Use. That goes over basic terms and tools that you need to know to be able to dismantle hatred, or when you encounter racism, bigotry, and prejudice, you'll know how to handle it. And also we talk about bystander intervention. When you do encounter it, how do you react? What steps should you do? And we also have another workshop, how to talk with kids about race, not how to talk to kids, but with kids, because it's a conversation. It's not a lecture, because kids recognize race. They recognize color at a very young age. It's disingenuous to believe that, oh no, they're just kids, they don't know. They recognize and they know it. So that's another workshop we hold. We also have a monthly book club, which if you're interested, you can go onto our website to find out more information, but it's held on the fourth Tuesday of every month. So in November, we'll be reading Fool's Crow by James Welsh. That's in honor of Native American History Month, or Indigenous Peoples History Month. And then we have December off because Christmas and all the religious holidays, Hanukkah. So who wants to go to a book club during the holiday season? But in January, we'll be reading There, There by Tawny Orange. And that's a bookend to Fool's Crow because There, There is about urban Indians, which we'll be very excited. And you can get these books at the Bozeman Public Library. If you go up to the desk, they have them set aside.
And where does the book club meet?
We meet at the Bozeman Public Library in the community room. But again, all this information is on our website, or our Facebook, or on Twitter, or on Instagram.
Pat, I was wondering if you could share a little bit about current issues that face Native communities.
Gladly. There are plenty to get involved with happening all around the country. So to start, there's the movement that has been happening that has gained a lot of momentum in the past year, referred to on social media as MMIW, or Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. It focuses on the trend that's been occurring throughout history of Indigenous women being specifically targeted, in the statistics show, mainly by non-Indigenous perpetrators due to various jurisdictional disputes that happen on Indigenous land. And that is, you know, a very big topic right now that's being discussed all throughout Indian country. There's also multiple pipelines going through multiple Indigenous territories. We've got the Line 3 out in Wisconsin. We've got the Keystone XL that is cutting through Montana, as well as other states. There's no shortage of issues going on, including recent issues with the Indian Child Welfare Act that unfortunately I'm not too read up on as of now. It only recently came out as a big issue. But if anyone is interested in knowing more about Indigenous issues, in all honesty, keep your eye on the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is more often than not where a lot of these Indigenous issues end up going. So keep an eye out for that.
Yeah, we also do have a Facebook for the Native American Studies community here on campus. It's just Native American Studies at MSU. And then we run our own Society of American Indian Graduate Students Facebook account. And we do try and keep a lot of current information on both of those platforms. Yeah, I think that Pat's right, though, talking about the Supreme Court. Because tribes are their own sovereign nations, a lot of legal disputes go to the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, we are not seeing a lot of success as far as rulings in favor of Indian community from the Supreme Court. We're actually more successful at this time in Congress. The election being having just passed, we might see some changes in Congress for representing Indian community. One of the current conversations that's big as far as within Congress goes is the VAWA's Violence Against Women Act. And Violence Against Women Act has been around for quite a while now, since the late 90s. And it's focusing on all different kinds of women, not just Indian women, but lesbian, gay, bi women, and any marginalized women, young women who are minors, things like that. Just the ultimate protection, congressional protection, and acknowledgement that women in this country face different issues. But VAWA at this particular time is up for reauthorization. It's called the 2018 reauthorization. And it has some specific literature in the new bill for the safety of Indian women. And it also reframes the bill to look beyond just domestic violence and look at violence that isn't between domestic partners, violence that is everything from the real stranger danger to violence of perpetrators in institutions, violence on through technology, whether it's stalking in social media, sex trafficking, child endangerment, all of those type of things. So this reauthorization coming up, it's set to be ruled on at least by the end of the year. And it has a lot of really important legislative changes. So if anyone's interested in keeping up on some of the current issues that face specifically Indian women or really women of all kinds, VAWA is definitely where to look for that.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you bring up VAWA and MMIW, the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. I know that with the HEART Initiative, which is focused on anti-trafficking efforts, we see Native communities and African Americans facing higher rates of trafficking and other forms of violence. So it is so crucial to know what is happening at like the legislative level and just in our communities so we can know how we can take action and learn more to educate ourselves. So what are some of the current events or recent events that you guys have had to further your mission?
Well, we've just celebrated Indigenous People Day, People's Day, which Bozeman does celebrate. There was a couple of new cities picked it up this year, Seattle.
Columbus, Ohio.
Out of all of them, is not celebrating Columbus Day anymore. That's an exciting change, and it makes me hopeful that other communities will change too. Mm-hmm. But Indigenous People's Day has, at least here on the university, expanded to Indigenous People's Month. So all of October, we're having some excellent things happening here on campus. And then coming up in November, we also have a presentation by Mike Jetty focusing on Indian education efforts in Montana. Here in Montana, we have in our constitution the Montana Indian Education for All, meaning that every institution at every grade level should be discussing educating students about Montana Indians. So he's going to be talking about that a little bit further here on campus, November 14th from 4:30 to 6:30. In Leon Johnson 339, if anyone's interested, which we'll be posting on our Facebook if anyone wants to check that out later. We also have Spring Powwow and the Spring Film Festival right around the corner.
Those are always really big events, right?
Mm-hmm. We have a film festival, and it's called the Indigenous Film Festival.
So clever.
It's a film festival that focuses on indie films done by Indigenous filmmakers. And the topics range anywhere from fry bread competitions to talk on MMIW to discussions of metal bands on the res. So there's a big array of topics being covered, both lighthearted and then also political and topical on issues in Indian country.
And when is that?
That is the week of powwow.
Well, as always, occurs in the spring, normally the end of March. This year should be just as big as all the other years. We actually host the largest campus powwow on the Northwest Coast. So it's always a good time. We have dancers from all over. It is an international powwow because we do have a lot of dancers come down from Canada. But we always try and time our particular film festival with the powwow.
And are non-native people welcome to come to that as well?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a huge misconception that we hear from a lot of people. White folks not knowing that they can come to a powwow, not knowing if they're welcome. There are plenty of times that people from outside Native communities cannot participate in things like tribally specific ceremonial powwows. But the one that we host at MSU, it's going to be March 30th and 31st. It is a public powwow. It's a competition powwow. These dancers compete for some really phenomenal prizes, thousands of dollars. We have competitions between the different drum groups, singing competitions. So we always also have vendors that sell different indigenous jewelry, art. We normally have representation from other communities here from MSU. Sages normally puts up a representation, and even the BSU normally has representation at our powwow. But yeah, everyone is welcome to attend.
Yeah, and how big is the attendance on that usually? Is that a pretty good crowd?
Fills up the field house.
Wow, that's impressive. So, yeah. I remember checking that out last year and just being really impressed by how many people are there and the enthusiasm for it. So yeah. If you're interested, you can look for that on their social media, and it's coming in March.
Okay, so some things that the Black Student Union will be doing in the month of October. We're supposed to walk for the first time in the Homecoming Day Parade, which is very exciting. We won't be having any like huge events in 2018. We won't have like our first big event until like 2019 in February for MLK Day, of course. And also we want to do something for Black History Month.
And what month is that again?
February.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So that's really exciting. We're just really brainstorming now and trying to have a set plan, but we don't really know what we're doing yet.
Yeah, I get that. As a fellow student organization, it can be kind of difficult with all the homework and stressors of school, but it's really inspiring to be able to work with so many different people and get events planned about things that matter. Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. You have been listening to the Community Action League as we're talking with the Society of American Indian Graduate Students, Montana Racial Equity Project, and the Black Student Union, as well as the Heart Initiative, which is based out of MSU. So today we've talked a lot about different marginalized populations, from American Indians, Native Americans, to African Americans in the United States. We hope to bring you more content like this next week. Keep tuned to learn more about issues that impact our community. We are going to try to have Montana Racial Equity Project and the Black Student Union back to talk more about Black History Month, and would love to talk more with Erica and Pat from SAGES to learn more about issues facing Native Americans. Thanks for listening.